3, recover to the left.
All right. Welcome, everybody, to the third Independent Workers Assembly of the Independent Workers Club of North America. This is an event called What Does the Election Mean for Labor? Now, you're probably guessing that when we set this event up, we kept things vague because we didn't know who was going to win. Obviously, now we're on the other side of that, and we've got some great panelists tonight to discuss what the implications are of the election, of Donald Trump's presidency, for labor broadly, the working class in general. We are the ILC. The ILC is a relatively new organization. We started about 6 or 7 months ago. There'll be more about that later, explaining our group and all that stuff. But the independent labor assemblies are our chance to bring people together to discuss, you know, hot button issues when it comes to what the working class is facing, what the working class is dealing with. The last one was on immigration and labor. This one's obviously about the election. And the first one was on, I'm blanking on it. It was the first one. just a couple few announcements before we get started. And I'm going to introduce the panelists. We have another event. So the ILC, we've got a bunch of chapters that have started around the country and some internationally. I'd like to announce that we have a another event coming up on November 23rd here at Woodbine Space. Jamie Merchant, who people might know from Brooklyn Rail, the publication, the political economist, he's going to be here, not in the capacity as an ILC leader, but talking about his new book, Endgame. So if people are around for the 23rd, that's good. So without further ado, I'm Sean KB. I have a podcast called The Antifada. I'm a rank and file dock builder, local union 1556, district council of carpenters. And until we get 50 members and can have proper elections, I am the dictatorial spokesperson of the Independent Labor Club of North America. I'm proud to announce our wonderful panelists this evening. First, we have Aaron Lalonde from the International Longshore Association out of Bayonne, New Jersey. Welcome, Aaron. We have Sue Mee, who is both a member of the Writers Guild of America East and also of the organization Left Voice. So welcome, Sue Mee. We have Ellie Pfeiffer of the Maoist Communist Union and formerly of Amazonians United. Welcome, Ellie. And speaking of issues confronting the working class, our fourth panelist, Laura Gabby from the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and DSA, was unable to make it this evening because of a childcare emergency. So one of the many, many reasons why it's tough for working class people to get together, discuss the issues that they have, discuss politics, of course, is because of a lack of childcare. So in her place, we have returning champion Gregory Butler, formerly of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, now an operating engineer, and the publisher and founder of a great resource, Gangbox News, which is a blog about the building trade. So thank you, everybody, for coming. Now I'm going to have a seat. So what does the election mean for labor? The first question we have here comes from the group, from the ILC. I think, a good way to lead things off, because obviously this is a time a lot of people are scared for obvious reasons. A lot of things are up in the air. People are shocked by the election, but also some people are not so shocked because we've been through this 8 years ago and, you know, we're at it again. So we'll go in order like this. So we'll start with Aaron on this question. In 2015, Steve Bannon, a self-described Leninist, who's just been released from prison, vowed to transform the GOP into a, quote, workers' party. When Trump was first elected the next year, much of his support was seen to come from the white working class. A few days ago, in his second successful election, this support seemed to expand to include a broader multiracial coalition of workers, peeling off large swaths of the Latino vote and increasing his numbers among black voters. A day after the election, Bernie Sanders tweeted that the Democrats had abandoned the working class, so the working class abandoned them. The Democrats are today seen as the party of university-educated professionals, while the Republicans have captured the vote of workers without college degrees. How are we to explain this dramatic realignment? Does it simply reflect racism and misogyny on the part of the American electorate, or is there something else going on? Aaron.
Well, clearly racism and misogyny is a factor. I mean, I'm not going to deny that. However, you know, I think it's less about Republicans becoming a part of the working class or the Democrats leaving the working class, as Bernie somewhat has put it. You know, they... I believe he just barely won white, you know, white style college degree. He actually did a little bit better than he did last time. So, you know, his appeal isn't really providing anything material to them. It's just a sense that they've been wronged and someone's going to fight for them, fight for things they care about, you know. And I think we're all part of guilty of this, you know. I don't think Bernie Sanders would have gotten Medicare for All. But why did I support him? Because he was going to fight for me. And I think this is how these people feel about Trump. So.
You have the chief mic right here.
But no, I think this is a really interesting question because this question of de-alignment, I think, has been top of the mind for everybody all of this week. Like whether it is, you know, the right wing of the Democratic Party to the New York Times to even Jacobin, like talking about this flight of workers away from the Democratic Party. And I think a lot has been said about, you know, this question of like college and non-college educated, like this whole, you know, diploma divide. But beyond that, I think it's important for us to also see this other question of income. I think Trump made huge gains amongst workers who made under $100,000 a year versus, you know, people and Harris made huge gains amongst people who make like over $100,000 a year. Trump made between like 12 and 15 points within that demographic. But I think that it's interesting to think about like why this has happened, and it's hard to like talk about it without thinking about what the experience of the pandemic in many ways, you know, for the working class. And that's the story of the last 4 years, a pandemic where the working class had a huge shift in consciousness of seeing themselves as essential, but also were the ones who had to work. You know, like I have like friends who worked in warehouses through it all while, you know, the bosses quarantined. And we've seen after that, like, you know, the great resignation where workers fed up by these conditions, you know, left feeling left behind, where the unions didn't fight for PPE protections, didn't fight for better conditions, and didn't fight to unionize new workplaces. Workers left the workplace. And then on the second hand, we have workers who unionize their workplace. But from that, we've also had the emergence of like two new leaderships within the labor movement with Sean Fain and Sean O'Brien, you know, trying to make that case for this new union, like, you know, this sector of workers who want to, you know, like unionize their workplaces, but also fight against divisions, want to fight for trans healthcare like Starbucks workers, you know, fight against tiered work like in Kellogg's. But it's hard to like think about this de-alignment without also seeing the role that these leaderships played in terms of leaving behind this the most precarious sectors of the working class over the last 4 years. We have to look at the Teamster strike, which was one of the most high-profile strike campaigns within labor, where a tentative agreement was pushed down, which maintained one of the biggest divisions, like off-tiered work within labor between warehouse workers and drivers. Drivers made far more money in Teamsters, while warehouse workers who are disproportionately Black, Brown, immigrant, make pittances for similar backbreaking work. And on the other hand, even though Fain did better with the big three auto strike, he immediately also endorsed Joe Biden and then Harris, while Biden broke the rail worker strike and didn't pass the PRO Act, didn't change like minimum wage laws at all, which really hurt a working class that was feeling the pinch of inflation in their pockets. And it's within that like that's the side of labor that Trump appealed to, you know, like Trump's base appealed to this most precarious sector within the working class, that, you know, like saying that, hey, I'm the one who'll put money in your wallet, like, you know, and be the ones who, you know, be like, and because, and you know, attacked immigrants as the ones, those who are getting all of the government handouts over working people. And I think, like, for us, like, this de-alignment isn't just a question of this or that campaign promises, what could Harris have said better, but also a story of a Democratic Party and an alliance with labor that has bought off, you know, a sector of the working class with some crumbs while leaving the vast majority of it in absolute dire straits.
Thank you for that. Ellie, your thoughts on this question?
Yeah, so I think it is important to ask when we talk about Trump and this realignment in terms of right-wing populism appealing to the workers, whether, you know, are they really pro-union? Obviously, that's a complex question. Or should we just treat this behavior that they have as a lie? Should we just treat the fact that they're supporting the workers in rhetoric as meaning nothing about their interests in maintaining their class rule? And I think both treating it as just straight up a lie or treating it as, you know, Trump genuinely caring about workers, either of those options I think are wrong. We do have to analyze what are the interests of the ruling class in this particular context. Why would a subsection of the Republican Party start espousing support for the unions? And it's not just that they want to win votes in these elections. They also are recognizing that the U.S. imperialist order is in a crisis, given competition with China and increasing imperialist competition more broadly. The U.S. recognizes they really have to change their shit around if they want to maintain their class rule. And what that means is that they're starting to reject neoliberalism. And, you know, we see this started in 2008, but the ruling class realizes that they can't rule in the typical way that they have with the neoliberal consensus of outshoring production, that they really have to move quite significant amounts of production back to the U.S. through nearshoring, reshoring, but also through nearshoring with oppressed countries that they believe they can control, like Mexico. And you see that with their new trade deal replacing NAFTA, the USMCA. And so the ruling class is realizing that if they want to maintain their place in the world, their ability to rape and plunder other countries, then they actually do need to use the unions. Use them not because they support the workers, but because they see them as a tool to maintain their control over production. And they recognize that this massive shift of shifting key industries to the U.S. Is going to require a lot of, or is going to create a lot of economic instability. And so, okay, the ruling class sees that happening, that need to happen. Well, how do you better control the people to make that kind of shift happen with this massive instability? Well, in certain cases, the unions are useful. It makes sense to appeal to the workers, to appeal to a sense of nationalism, a sense that they have a stake in their country or their workplace. It's definitely reflective, the election results, of a real lack of political leadership of the working class, a real crisis, not just within the ruling class, but also among the union leaders, these class collaborationists who are willing to sell out the workers. You know, we saw that with Biden, with Sean Fain when he endorsed Biden. He literally said, Biden has been perfect for the working class, something like that. Okay, bro, like 2 years ago, he literally sold out the workers of the railroad strike. You know, it's just, that's just not true. And so workers do see there's this lack of political leadership. They see their own union leaders, you know, lying to them. And workers aren't stupid. So there is a need to to develop a real independent political action of the working class and real leadership. Because if not, yeah, of course, workers are going to be, you know, they feel like they have a false choice. And I think it's our duty as people who are, you know, anti-capitalist or revolutionary minded to step in and to put forward a path forward, or, you know, to put forward a path to get out of this as the ruling class tightens their rule.
Thank you, Ellie. All right, Greg.
Yeah, well, first things first, we don't have a working class party in this country. We've never had a working class party in this country. It's kind of part of the problem. Why is that? Well, in part, we have a racially divided working class. That's been a weapon they've been using to divide us, going back to before the United States was a country, going back to the days of slavery. So we don't really have a workers' party. We have two parties that serve the upper classes, just they serve them in different ways. And this point in modern times, pretty much if you make less than $100,000 a year, neither party gives a damn about you. If you make less than $20,000 a year, both parties see you as a problem to be managed. And by being managed, in the worst sense of the term, that's the people that get deported. That's the people that get locked up. And neither party is going to do anything about that. So now, in terms of demagogy, when unions weren't as weak as they are now, the Democrats used the union movement and they pretended to be pro-labor. They were allied with the union leadership and the class collaborationist wing of the union leadership, pushing the unions towards selling insurance and being junior partners with the Chamber of Commerce back when the unions weren't as weak as they are now. But at the moment, less than 6% of the private sector workforce are unionized. At the moment, less than 2% of workers under 30 are unionized. So the Democrats have become very much the party of the privileged white-collar layers of the class. That's who they orient towards. That's why they market their presidential candidates. Like, they marketed Mrs. Harris as, excuse the expression, a girl boss. They kind of marketed Mrs. Clinton the same way. And that appeals to that class, to the rest of us. That reminds us of our boss or the people in HR, and not in a good way. And that's why those two candidates lost to an idiot who was a convicted felon, which is a spectacular level of incompetence, especially considering how much money they paid to do that. Now, the Republicans have started demagogically appealing to workers or to white workers, and during all this campaign, the only time I've ever heard actual working class people mentioning anything related to the campaign, that thing about making overtime tax free and making tips tax free.
That went over.
I've heard that. The day after the elections, I was at work. I was running a training for some of my coworkers. One of the workers in the training, kind of a smart ass, and he likes to joke around. Then what was he joking around about? Oh, they're going to make overtime tax free. Oh, fun fact, most of the workers in that class were people of color. There's only two white guys in the room. That man was South Asian. And that's something that thing about eliminating taxes for overtime and tips, wildly popular. Now, is it going to happen? Absolutely not. They'd have to amend the federal tax code. They'd have to amend the Fair Labor Standards Act. Even if they wanted to do that, that'd be a lot more difficult than it sounds. And especially they'd also have to amend the tax codes of the 50 states and 6 territories of this country and amend the Fair Labor Standards Act of those states and territories. That's as difficult as it sounds. And that's if they were serious about it. And I'm old. I remember Trump from back in the 70s. He's an old school New York hustler. He's a liar. Everything he says is demagogic nonsense. He's not planning on doing that, but I think what appealed to people, even people that were smart enough to know, yeah, this guy's a hustler. He's a liar. He's a con artist. But at least he had the decency to lie to us, to act like he might do something for us, as opposed to Mrs. Harris, who basically doesn't care about us. If you make less than 100 grand a year, she doesn't care about you. And that was super obvious. And that's why her whole political career, she's been wildly unpopular. She has a devoted fan base online, and she's been really leaning into that social media thing. But in the real world, It's really hard for her to win elections. There's a reason why they had to push her through without a primary. And I think that didn't go over very well either. Was race and misogyny a factor? Well, this is America. Race is a factor in everything. And I'm sure there is a certain element of Americans, plus this is a very Christian country. A lot of Christians are very uncomfortable with women in a leadership position. They'll quote from scripture about where women are supposed to not speak, and even in the church, they're supposed to follow the leadership of their husbands, and a lot of those folks genuinely believe in that. I have family members who genuinely believe in that. But was that the main factor? No. I think Trump won the election in large part because of that lie. And the fact that the Democrats didn't counter that, because why? Like the Republicans, they're a party of the upper classes, but the difference is they serve the upper classes in different ways.
Thank you, Greg. Greg, you began sort of...
Yeah, we can clap for that.
In your response there, you kind of touched on what my next question for you folks is going to be, because if we wanted to have, like, groundbreaking election analysis, we'd get Rachel Maddow here, or we'd get, what's another one of those fools? I don't know. Joy Reid, or like a professor or something like that. Who could? There was plenty of crying the other night, I'll give you that. But no, we wanted to bring on workers, fellow workers, rank and file workers, all of us in unions or have been in unions, to get a kind of an on the ground view of these things. So the next question, and I'll shoot this to you first, Aaron, and we'll go back around. What kind of reactions have you gotten around this election from your coworkers? So in the Longshore Association, are they generally pro-Trump or pro-Harris, or are most of them kind of checked out, or is it a mix?
It's definitely a mix. You know, it basically breaks down among the demographic lines that you've heard. Maybe I should further explain this. For a lot of reasons, there's kind of an idea that the longshore industry is dominated by white males. It's actually not true. We're a majority and minority union. So, less so in New York than in the South, but even in New York, we still are. So, you know, it's split evenly among the white workers. It's the, you know most African-American workers. We're Harris, you know. A big change among Latinos, it just breaks it down. A lot of them also are checked out. Also, I do see with the younger men, just like they're saying. Of course, in our case, it's a little hard to say. We have like a hiring, you know, there's a lot of veterans, so obviously they're going to be on it. I don't, you know, but I think most of them don't really think it's going to materially affect them, because it won't.
Ultimately, yeah. Sumi, go ahead.
So I'm a rank and file WGAE member, part of a small magazine shop called like the Hearst Magazines Union. So I work in media, which very much like in a part of liberal media, you know, like we make fancy house, like, I don't know, cute magazines. As part of like every other media, I think it skews heavily Democrat. Not only within my coworkers, I've had get out the vote emails come from corporate throughout in the weeks coming like before that, and I think this week has been especially weird for me as a communist in the workplace to see a bunch of people like really just like actually crying. Yes, there were tears. But I think that there's also something like that's just half the story, like in terms of the despair around Harris's election, like loss and Trump's win, because I think that there's a sector that feels far more existential dread. But I think that the other part of that is the fact that I have a lot of young coworkers, people who came of age through the Biden administration, through like the first Trump years. Are like a downwardly mobile middle class, you know, like, you know, they are not going to have better lives than their parents did. Their home ownership and all of those dreams are, you know, they lie in the dust. And they also have been like over the last years been a part of the pro-Palestine movement, like especially over the last year seeing the are absolutely like horrified by Israel's genocide in Gaza and have a lot of anger towards the Democratic Party establishment too, like hate Biden. See Harris as someone who's like complicit too, like in this genocide, and in at least within that sector of my coworkers, like and union members, like, there was a sense of, like, holding their nose and voting for Harris, and that, I think, became even more acute, particularly as she tacked even more to the right, like, you know, like, as she aligned, like, moved right on almost every issue, like, whether it was immigration or climate change, like, on the question of imperialism and the military, like, I think that they were incredibly turned off. Like, you know, it's a generation that has, like, that doesn't believe in this kind of labor peace between the bosses and workers and want to fight for a different world. And I think also, like, it's been interesting to also see the clarity of, like, why Harris lost. Like, I don't, like, it's interesting this discussion of, like Gregory was putting forward too about, like, this girl bossness of it all, like this feeling of, like, you know, like, I think it's interesting to see the death of progressive neoliberalism in some ways, like, of seeing the way that, like, representation doesn't equal liberation anymore. Like, I don't think, like, I think it's different from, feels different from 2016 when Hillary won, where it felt like the question of, like, oh, like, this country would never elect a female president felt more prescient, versus now, where with Harris, like, I think that there is a lot more understanding why this campaign lost and why Trump won, especially as, like, Harris had little to, like, nothing to offer except empty platitudes.
Yeah, thank you. Allie, go ahead.
Yeah, so I left Amazon a couple months ago, but so I have, you know, I've stayed in touch with some people, but overall, I mean, people were talking about the election before, before now. And I think one moment that was pretty striking to me was I was pulling off the belt some boxes, and they were just piling up. And usually the way it works at Amazon is you have people lined up across the belt, and basically if you miss some of your boxes, it kind of fucks over the person down the line from you. And there's someone ahead of me who was struggling, but partly she was struggling because the person ahead of her was struggling. I'm really management, which pushing the boxes way too fast. And she complained to me. She said, "This is why we need Trump." She's a black woman. This is why we need Trump, because these immigrants they don't care about their jobs. You know, they're fucking it over for us. We have too many in this city. You know, we need to, get rid of them or whatever she said. And yeah, I just remember being taken aback by how her anger was taken out on our coworker. I know, trying to explain to her, like, okay, there is some aspect to what's going on in this city where the Democrats are fucking up. You know, they don't have enough, organization. I mean, obviously there's enough space. There's these empty buildings for billionaires, you know, lots of them throughout the city. But, you know, they're very disorganized in dealing with immigration. And, you know, we should be mad, too, that there are people who are coming to this country because the U.S. has messed up their countries back home. And yeah, like, what you're doing right here is just very inconducive to the solidarity that we need to actually solve the problems that you're raising. So I think, yeah, there's obviously a lot of anger, but people are not so equipped to stand together. And obviously, like, that's one example. I think there are plenty of people who, I'd say the vast majority of my coworkers at Amazon, you know, I couldn't tell now, but definitely weren't planning on voting when I was there. You know, they just feel fed up with the system and the two parties and pretty apathetic. You know, some people, there will always be, you know, more advanced workers with more developed class consciousness. And, you know, there will be more backwards people like this woman on the line. And I think it's a question for us to not be overwhelmed by the reality that a lot of people are taking up really oppressive ideas right now in light of their oppressive conditions. But we have to recognize that there's a way to strategically approach that, you know, historically, you know, communist and revolutionary minded people have united with those advanced workers. And, you know, those advanced workers can win over the intermediate. And yeah, we shouldn't be discouraged that that people are taking up negative ideas. And we should seize on the opportunity provided by the apathy of people not voting.
Absolutely. Greg, go ahead.
Okay, so I work for a city government agency. There's two different sets of people that work at our agency. The people who are the clerical and admin staff, they're in District Council 37 of AFSCME. A lot of them are African-American women. There's also a lot of immigrants from various parts of the world, but the bulk of that workforce is African-American women. Then there's the people that do various specialized things for the agency. My title, we're part of the Operating Engineers Union. A lot of us are immigrants from all over the place, Middle East, from the African, black people from the Caribbean, South Asians from the Caribbean, South Asians from South Asia, and people from the Middle East, Arabs and other Middle Eastern nationalities. Most of us are Democrats. Some of the white workers at our agency and some of the U.S. citizen Latinos are Republicans. But what was remarkable for considering there was a presidential election, which every night when I'd go home and go on social media, I'm being told that Trump is Hitler. This is Germany in 1933. And I see all that fear talk. And then I go in real life. And for an agency that, well, we work for the government, most of us are registered Democrats. And some of them, particularly the black women who are the backbone of the admin side of our workforce, are all registered Democrats. And normally moderately vocal about that. The degree of not at all being engaged by this, which was astounding, especially considering the media campaign, plus in real life, no one would talk about it. It was really astounding. And I actually, normally I'm mostly in the field. I was in the office the day after the election, which I'm rarely there in person. But when I was there, it was astounding that I'd been all night on social media. I'd heard all the wailing and yelling. And then in person, somebody made a joke about it. And other than that, no one talked about it because, well, to a large degree, we work for the city. The federal government has very little influence in what we do. And in general, you know, we live in a federal republic. 90% of the laws that affect you are state laws enforced by people who work for local government agencies, people like myself. So it just maybe because of what we do, we're a little more grounded with the reality that, well, the big difference of this election is that the federal government is going to keep doing the toxic things they do. They're still, especially we get to see a little bit of how our brothers and sisters who are asylum seekers are treated. We get to actually see that in person. I've physically been in some of those hotels where they have them living and seen how they have them living. And that's an indictment of the federal government and how they've mishandled this. But the fact is, to a large degree, for those folks for whom federal policy very much affects them, the big difference is not far from my office, there's a couple of federal office buildings where they make them line up to apply for whatever the process they have to go through to apply to get their status regularized. And every morning, when I'm coming down to the on occasions when I come to the office, I pass by them. There's a line of people there at 7 o'clock in the morning who've obviously been there for hours. And I think the main impact of the election is going to be on those folks is that if you go in the lobby of those buildings, that picture in the lobby right now, there's a picture of Mr. Biden. And in about 2 months, they're going to take that picture down. They're going to put up a picture of Mr. Trump. But the way those people are mistreated and the way those people are abused, and it's something I've seen in person, really make, I normally am a fairly calm person, very few things upset me, and I see a lot of bad things in the course of my work. It really upsets me. These people are coming here looking for help. We have an obligation, our government has an obligation under international treaties to protect these people, and they're doing the opposite of that, and that's absolutely not going to change. This country's been deporting 300,000 to 400,000 people a year for the last 30 years. Presidency in, presidency out, the older Bush, Clinton, the younger Bush, Obama, who deported more people than any president in American history, 5.2 million people, and Trump and Biden. Trump actually did a fairly bad job of deporting people. He only
surprise,
deported 1.2 million people. Mr. Biden deported 1.5 million. And oh, one other note, they're going to deport 20 million people. No. Department of Homeland Security has capacity to deport a maximum of about 400,000 people a year in terms of the number of people they have and the people from the U.S. Marshal Service and the U.S. Public Health Service that have to are involved in the deportation process, and the private security contractors and the county sheriff's departments that run their detention facilities. That's how many beds they have. That's how many people they can process. And the foreign embassies and consulates, particularly the consulates of the United States and Mexico, that have to provide these people with passports. They got to give them a travel documents before they deport them. Their capacity is they can do about 400,000 passports a year for the deportation. There is, if you work in government, you learn there's hard budgetary limits to everything. People can say they want to do everything, but there's a finite amount of money and a finite amount of people to do these things. That's not going to change. Basically, the name or the picture in the lobby of the building where the deportees get processed will change. There'll be a picture of Mr. Trump instead of a picture of Mr. Biden. But if you're being taken by the U.S. Marshals to the airport and maybe they're in a good mood and they didn't put the shackles on, and you're being put in that white bus with the windows blacked out so you can't see where you're going to go to the airport, to be put in that plane to wherever it is that they're deporting you to, which might be a country you left as a small child that you've never been to, that's not going to change at all. And that, I think, is the defining aspect of this election, that, again, these parties don't serve us, and they're making that more and more clear.
Thank you, Greg. So, for our next question, it's fortunate that Aaron is going to be the first one to answer this, considering in October, the ILA went out on a brief strike, is that right?
Yes.
And had a temporary agreement. So we'll get your take on this for this question. What role did your unions play in the election? Did they endorse a candidate, and did they say why? Follow-up here is what sort of issues are currently facing your industry and how might politics affect it? But talk a little bit, Aaron, about the ILA and the election.
Yes. So we had not endorsed anyone so far. But I think the election was key to the success of our strike. Our leader is, it's a very conservative union. He's a conservative man himself. It wouldn't surprise me if he voted for Trump. But to my surprise, he saw the idea that this was the time. Global supply chains were at their weakest, and there was an election a month away. And I think if it had not been in that context, that Biden would have enacted Taft Hartley and put us back to work. But there was just no way that was going to fly in the Rust Belt, especially a month. If it was a year ago, they probably would have forgotten about it. They just would have voted for him anyways, which is a larger point. Elections are important, but they're not important the way we talk about it. It's not important who wins. It's the kind of leverage that we can use. And they don't, going on strike is a political act. And that's the disconnect we have nowadays. I mean, most of my coworkers don't realize that. And more important, protesting, all of that stuff, these are all political acts, and these are kind of really what we need to get back to.
So my union, WGA West, Writers Guild West, endorsed Harris for president. Writers Guild East did not make any endorsements this cycle, but if you look at their donations, they donate to both parties. They donate to Democrats a little bit more. It's also, for me, it's a really interesting time to be in media, and not just because, especially as, thinking about this question of, uniting the ranks of the working class, across, these divisions, because so much, for very long, our unions have been so, committed to this, maintaining labor peace, with the bosses. And in that way, let's not talk about politics, it's a constant presence within our union. Our leadership is actually quite conservative in that sense. Yet our unions do play political roles, because they do every year, almost every union, does put in money into presidential candidates, into either the two parties of capital, whether at local levels, whether towards get out the vote efforts, which is towards driving votes for the Democratic Party, or direct donations through their PACs. For me, it's also a struggle that, especially as a media union, at a time when media is playing such a complicit role in the genocide in Palestine in terms of the coverage and the cover that it has given U.S. imperialism, it's frustrating, you know, to be that the fights for Palestine against discrimination, against the divisions within our class, when we fight for those things, our union's response is always let's not get political because our membership is very diverse, but somehow it really doesn't matter when it comes to the question of donations, which are happening on the backs of our dues, instead of going towards new organizing, instead of giving towards solidarity with other workers, especially as even Gregory talked about, we are 10% of the labor movement is organized. That's insane, in the richest country in the world. And what are we doing in that sense? For me, that has been my experience this election cycle with my union. And I think it's a good microcosm of a relationship with the labor movement at large that I think is important for us to talk about.
Yeah, thank you. Ellie.
Yeah, so I was involved with some of the campaigns to organize Amazon, initially with an independent union or the formation of an independent union, but we were also involved with working with the Teamsters. So I can talk a little bit about how the Teamsters approached the election.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're an interesting case, right? So Sean O'Brien, the president of the Teamsters, he decided not to endorse any candidate after polling the members. And he also decided not to endorse after he spoke at the Republican National Convention. He gave a pretty insane speech. he called Trump one SOB, which is also a reference to him, his own name, which is funny. But
Sean O'Brien.
Yeah, Sean O'Brien. he also spoke to his recognition that there is this growing contingent within the Republican Party that is nominally supporting the unions. He also spoke to the way he thinks about politics as a union official. And he sees it really, as Shumi said, a collaboration with the capitalists. But he also does recognize that there is this shift in the economic policy of the ruling class. He spoke to how Amazon is somewhat of a traitor to the national security interests of the country because they have production in China. And so he's very much getting behind the shift that the ruling class is making towards nearshoring and reshoring of production. He sees that as very much in line with his interests, and we see that with other union officials like Sean Fain and seeing the provisions that the new USMCA, the new NAFTA, have for auto production and union jobs in North America, which also the AFL-CIO wrote in large parts. You see Sean O'Brien recognizing that even if he doesn't endorse a candidate, he's still endorsing the ruling class and he's still selling out workers. And yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of ways we can think about this. On the one hand, it's messed up, and we should criticize him. We shouldn't be afraid to criticize the union officials. But also, I think we could see it as an opportunity to expose the contradictions between the union leaders and their own staff. You know, just non-endorsing alone caused a lot of turmoil within the Teamsters. Having those town halls where workers were asked who to vote for, MCU as an organization had some comrades in the Teamsters who were able to raise those questions to workers. So it really provided an opportunity to expose the need to break from the parties. And yeah, we can see, I mean, obviously this non-endorsement in a lot of ways is a tepid endorsement of Trump. You know, we shouldn't be confused that he's, you know, advocating for independent action of the working class. But yeah, I think we could see it as a microcosm of something bigger, that it's a shift in labor and their orientation to politics that we can seize on.
Thank you. Greg.
Okay. Well, I'm a member of the International Union of Operating Engineers. It's a union that represents people that, the people on construction sites that operate bulldozers and cranes. They also represent the people called stationary engineers, who are the people who run boiler rooms in large office and commercial buildings. They also represent some people that work in the public sector in various construction safety and other building safety related jobs. And those of us in that last category are kind of stepchildren of the union. The union is more than happy to collect our dues. They don't do very much for us. And, well, as far as the elections, I have, for most of the 8 years I've been in this union, never heard anything from the international. Any communications from the union came from my local, not from the international to which we are affiliated. Well, a few months ago, I got a phone call from my international union. It was a push poll. This was when they were still trying to run Mr. Biden, despite his health issues. And it was framed as an opinion poll, but actually designed to get you to vote for that candidate. And the upshot of it was that since there's a small minority of our members who work in mining and the oil industry, the people that put up the oil derricks, those are people in my union. The people in the mines, with those, if you ever seen a strip mine, the people in those, the big cranes digging the coal out, the people that set the explosives in to blow up the dirt so the coal falls out, those are people in my union. They're a very small portion of the membership of the union, but the union devotes an enormous amount of energy to them, far disproportionate to their share in the membership. Well, the upshot of this hour-long conversation I had with someone from my union, first time my union's ever bothered to phone me about anything, was that I should vote for Mr. Biden because he will increase oil drilling and mining. Now, I know the dominant narrative of the Democratic Party has been, oh, we're the party of the environment, we care about global warming, we think it's a problem that it's 70 degrees in November, which, spoiler alert, it is. But the fact is that it was quite clear that the message that they've sent to my union and to the oil companies that own those mines and oil fields, where some of my union's members work, was that, well, we need to do more oil drilling and more mining. And this was presented as a good thing. And also I got a couple of two separate mailings of my union's magazine to me. My union's never bothered to send me its magazine in the 8 years I've been a member. I got two copies of the magazine the same day talking about how Mr. Biden has done more funding for construction, and that's the reason why you should vote for, well, Mrs. Harris. Of course, construction has become a very deunionized field. 90% of construction is non-union. Most construction is lower, and I see it every day in my work in public safety going to construction sites. It's a non-union job done by recent immigrants and people that just came home from prison. That's who works in construction. It's a low-wage job. It's literally a job that barely pays minimum wage. So, yeah, Biden is going to have more funding for that because that's 90% of what the industry is these days. That's why I left construction, because that's the job I was becoming. I wasn't interested in spending the last years of my working life doing that. And then finally I got a letter from Mr. Joseph Collins, who is the president of the International Union of Operating Engineers, a man who makes $500,000 a year, lives in a mansion in the D.C. suburbs, and he has a private jet that I helped to pay for. He's too good to fly commercial, not even first class. He has a private jet. And again, telling me it again, I should vote for Mrs. Harris because oil drilling and more funding for construction. So that's basically my union's position. And my local union, because we're a civil service local, they're very involved with supporting the local Democratic Party, Mr. Adams, and the Democratic Party here in New York City. They recently, our union dues went up, and they also set up a political action fund. So now we're paying, our union dues went up from $24 every 2 weeks to $37 every 2 weeks. And now there's also a $5 on top of that for the political action fund. And all that goes to the Democratic Party in Manhattan, Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island. In other words, to Mr. Adams' machine. all because their strategy for dealing with our issues were civil servants. We spent about 5 years, 5 years of my 8 years with the agency, we didn't have a contract. We have a contract now. It's going to expire next year. And we're probably going to go several years without a contract because, of course, we're not allowed to strike. If you even talk about striking, that's a crime. If you actually go on strike, the leaders of the union get locked up for civil contempt. They get to go to Rikers Island. And the members get fined 2 days' pay for every day on strike. Civil service unions in New York City have never done anything to fight that law because it helps them not do anything for us. Oh, well, we can't do anything about that because of the Taylor law. And they would be, and also it lets them be in the insurance business, which is very lucrative. They make a lot of money off the insurance. And a lot of that is, you know, the sort of usual corruption that goes along with that, down to and including when I was briefly a delegate in my local, the dental insurance company came to try and curry favor from us. And they're giving us free toothbrushes and toothpaste. Like, A, it's
what
a very,
were they trying to say? That your breath stank or something?
Well, you know what? It was an insulting attempt at a bribe. And also, for the record, it was the bribery of the most petty sort. And also the sort of thing that when we're at the job doing our work, our agency has a fairly strict anti-corruption policy. We're literally not supposed to take a bottle of water from people. If you're on a hot day, you go into the job site, hey, do you want a bottle of water? You're supposed to say no. So we're not allowed to take a bottle of water. And here we are in our capacity as union delegates. And they're giving us friggin' toothbrushes, which A, is insulting. If you're going to bribe us, bribe us. And B, it's like, okay, this is corruption and we shouldn't be doing this. And, you know, but yeah, again, it's something, again, it's also symbolic of why the union leadership supports the Democratic Party, despite the fact that union membership has drastically declined. You know, even in the public sector, only 34% of public sector workers are unionized. In the private sector, it's down to 6%. Construction, the industry I worked in the 1960s, 80% of construction was union. Today, it's 10% and falling. It went from a job that was a gateway in the time I was in the trades. I got in the trades in 1992, left in 2016. In the time I was in the trades, it went from a job that was a gateway to being middle income and being a homeowner and owning a car, to a job that you do if you just immigrated to this country as an asylum seeker and you need a job, or you just came home from prison and you need a job where they don't do background checks. That's who works in construction today. That's the job it became in the time I worked in it. And it's gotten worse since then. And is voting for the Democrats a solution to that? No, they caused the problem, as did the Republicans. It was a bipartisan attack on our class.
Thank you, Greg. Aaron, you had a follow-up, too, you want to say.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, Trump, you know, speaking to realignment, Trump came out and said he would not have invoked Taft Hartley. How true that is, I don't know, but I think there's a pretty reasonable chance he wouldn't have, considering the Rust Belt. So, anyways.
Do you think Trump saw the flack that Biden got breaking the railroad strike and he was a political consideration, or do you think that he truly believed the ILA had a right to strike?
No, it was a political, yeah. Not so much the flack of the railroad strike, just the fact of the importance of the Rust Belt and the fact that it was so close to the election. You know, the longshoremen probably would have remembered that, you know, 2 years from now. But the average factory worker in Pennsylvania probably wouldn't have.
Thank you. A couple more questions. I would like folks to know that at around 6 o'clock, delivery dependent, we're gonna have pizzas here. So there'll be a ton of pizzas in the back. We're gonna take a short break from this, have some pizza, have some drinks, whatever it is, and then we'll return to have a town hall. So we'll open the floor up and we won't record it, so you don't have to feel like you're on the spot, and we could all kind of give our thoughts on the panel, give our thoughts on the election. You can vent, you know, say whatever you'd like. So, with that said, next question. How was the Biden administration for you and your coworkers, and what do you think the Trump presidency has in store?
Well, the key thing is obviously not invoking the Taft-Hartley Act. As far as what Trump will have in store, you know, that's a very good question in terms of the tariffs. You know, they're obviously going to affect our industry. Having said that, you know, span of it. So we said earlier about workers who make over. Thanks to the post, I'm sure most of you know what me and my coworkers make. and how much our president makes. But even though, you know, they're in that category, they feel precarity. You know, they're not stupid. They know that high school dropouts don't make that kind of money anywhere else, and they have nowhere else to go. And so they feel, you know, they may not immediately feel the genetic, you know, direct financial costs of neoliberalism, but they feel it in precarity, and they see it in their communities and in their families. You know, it's definitely an open question. You know, I really don't think anyone knows how these tariffs are going to really come out, if they're going to happen, what's actually going to be the result of them. We shall see. You know, it's more, basically what politics these days is about identity more than anything else. You know, and let me make this clear. I'm not saying identity politics in the chance of, you know, marginalized groups trying to improve themselves. That's not what I mean. What I mean is, you know, you drink Black Rifle coffee, or you drive a truck, or you drive a Prius, or whatever. I mean, these are the kind of things that politics come down to these days.
Sumi, go ahead.
Yeah, I think, going to a lot of the discussions that we've been having already, I think, like, the Biden administration has been an interesting, like, 4 years after the first Trump one. But I think something that Ellie was talking earlier, too, like, you know, I think we're also in the midst of this huge, like, crisis of capitalism, like, especially, like, you know, like... We see, like, you know, I think enough has been written about the crisis of neoliberalism, about profit, like the rate of profit falling, and like, you know, like this tension of, like, yeah, like American capital, like having, like, you know, like very less motors of growth, and I think the pandemic in particular deepened that, particularly with, like, I think you know, like, we've had, like, so much discussion around, like, is this the end of globalization, you know, like. Whether, like, yeah, like, of the necessity, like, that it shows, like, yeah, like, a just-in-time supply chain that kind of failed, and this, intersecting with, like, increasing competition with China. But also, like, I think the Biden administration also, like, inherited a lot of the economic uncertainties that came after the pandemic, and I think that that has been, in many ways, the lived experience of the working class, like, across the country, including my coworkers and myself. Like, you know, we've seen eggs become, like, $8 a carton for 12. Like, that's insane. Like, I don't know. I just want to make my cookies. Come on. But, like, I don't know. Like, I think that it's something that when we see, like, you know, like, when voters went to the polls this year, like, saying that the economy was top in mind, like, for all of Biden's soft landing, like, it isn't something that most people felt in their pocket, and it's it feels a bit like a holding pattern, like, what's next for American capital, and with it, what is next for the American working class, like, and I think that on one hand, like, there is this, I think, all of the stuff that I was saying earlier, too, like, you know, like, it is also the experience, like, of, like, the Biden administration, like, under that, like, along with the alliances with sectors of the labor bureaucracy, like, particular, like, this new labor bureaucracy that's trying to rearticulate this relationship with this, like, new, like, you know, like, I don't know, in Left Voice, we fondly call them Generation U or for union, you know, like, this new generation of workers unionizing their workplaces, fighting for Palestine, fighting for abortion rights, trans healthcare, all of those things, like, it has to, like, find ways, like, you know, that is, yeah, like, as we've been talking, fed up with neoliberalism, fed up with the attacks that have happened on labor over the last 3 decades in particular, want more and have an appetite for more. But also, like, yeah, like, what has it cost us to, like, leave behind a whole sector of this working class? Like, and we see that in this new alliance that Trump made. Like, it isn't just a precarious white working, rural working class anymore. It's a diverse coalition, you know? Like, and we see, like, this is the demographics, Sean, you were talking about right at the top of this discussion, you know, like, and it goes to the heart of, yeah, like, not just, like, and it, we feel that across the board, but, yeah, like, the product of a whole sector of working class who was left behind, who were the biggest losers under neoliberalism, but have seen their work get even more precarious, you know, like, in particular with the Amazonification of work, and all of that. And I think, like, but, like, I think, like, Ellie, too, talked about this earlier on, like, you know, like, Trump is not, like for all of his talk, like he's not a friend of the working class at all. Like this is a new experience for the Republican Party, and the working class will go through that experience too of a Republican Party that is plans on unleashing huge attacks. Like, I don't know, Elon Musk and Donald Trump talked about firing striking workers.
Yes.
That's crazy. Yeah. And what is, like, you know, and I don't know, like, and I think for us, like, it's necessary for us to discuss what is the way, like, you know, in that way, and I know hopefully we'll get into it a bit more, but, like, yeah, like, that is the reality that the Trump presidency shows us, you know, like, Gregory talked about, like, the promise of, like, no taxes on tips or overtime. Beyond, like, you know, even if he's able to do so, that's an incredible precarization of work. It incentivizes precarious work without benefits, without, like, it's a huge attack. It changes the fabric of work for us.
I quickly, just a personal experience, the other day I had a discussion with an operating engineer on my job, and he was like, oh, yeah, the no tax on overtime is going to be huge for me. But I said, yeah, but do you realize that that means that this trend of like some people having no work or very little work and some people being completely overworked is only going to be exacerbated. And he just said to be like, oh, well, I guess so, but we'll work it out. So I agree with you. It's really going to continue these trends. And before we move on to Ellie, I would say maybe during the town hall, if I can put you back on the spot later, we can talk a little bit about white collar work and AI. Coming down the pipe. I think that'd be interesting. But Ali, go ahead for the question of what did Biden mean and what do you think Trump's going to mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think there has been a lot of talk recently, a lot of fear-mongering about a Trump presidency and how he's going to be just like Reagan. He's going to be, he's going to completely destroy the NLRB, all protections for workers. And I mean, in terms of the Biden administration, it's important to recognize that Biden was not so friendly to workers. You know, at Amazon and a lot of the even favorable rulings that they gave to workers, those would come 2-3 years later. You know, the NLRB in general is an institution that does not really like to act quickly or be so helpful, similarly to what you spoke to of, you know, these institutions just getting a new face. But yeah, I mean, another example of Biden's betrayal of the workers, even when it seemed like he was supportive of them, it relates to what Aaron was saying with regards to the strike that happened a couple months ago. I mean, yeah, he didn't invoke Taft-Hartley, but there was some news that came out that the Biden administration was meeting with the heads of the shipping companies and backdoor deals, basically to say, okay, you have X hours, you know, by the end of the day, if the strike's not over, well, you know, it was basically, you know, this deal that to make it seem like there's support there for the strike, but obviously they want it to happen to be over as quickly as possible. But yeah, in terms of whether we should really think of Trump as anti-union as Reagan, I think we should really analyze the particularities of the situation today and the situation that was facing Reagan in, you know, 1980 when he got elected. I mean, Reagan similarly was facing a crisis of U.S. imperialism. The U.S. dollar was plummeting; its gold value was plummeting. Basically they needed to save the U.S. dollar, and he inherited an administration that had just decided that the way to do that is to increase the interest rates for the businesses. When the interest rates go up, the capitalists, their ability to profit in a country like the U.S. goes down significantly. And so that really was behind why we had neoliberalism, because these high interest rates made it such that outsourcing of production was the only way to, you know, get some profits for the capitalists. And so what that meant was that Reagan and all the bourgeoisie around him were really empowered to say fuck you to the unions and not have any real repercussions, because their main strategy economically was to focus on exploiting the third world and to not care so much about American workers. Trump recognizes that he can't do that. And, you know, however conscious he is or not of this thing, he's facing a similar crisis of imperialism, but he does, in his moves to reshore and putting these tariffs, recognize he does have to rely on the working class, and to do that, use the unions as tools of the bourgeoisie. And yeah, I think it's important for us to keep in mind that anti-union or a president who's pro-union can be pro-worker, or can be, sorry, anti-worker, but that we have to actually think beyond this category of whether our politicians support unions or not. We have to think about, what are our unions? What are their politics? Are they, you know, aligning themselves with the ability for the capitalists to continue their class rule, or are they challenging them? And that challenge, even as the capitalists and Trump and his advisors will say that they support these unions, that challenge, if done well, you know, if actually sincere in putting forward an antagonistic relationship with the capitalists, will have them trembling. And I think that's what we have to keep in mind.
Thank you. Greg.
Okay, well, as far as how the Biden administration's affected us, well, we work for the city. So generally speaking, what affects us is a lot more local, the city and what it does, and budgetarily what it does. And honestly, as far as the city treats us like they always treat us, that we're always working years at a time without a contract, and when we get a raise, we're not nearly paid as much as we should be. And because we're divided up into a bunch of different unions, there's people that do the same work as me for different agencies who make way different money than I do. I make 70. There's people who do my job for the Department of Housing that make 60, same union as me. As people in the fire department do my job, that make 36. Same experience as me, same exact work. I occasionally get to work with these people who get paid half what I get paid. And that is something that has been that way since I've been with the city, and was that way long before I got there. Now, in terms of the social crises that we get to deal with, which we get to be on the front lines of, homelessness, inadequate housing, all that other stuff, the migrant crisis, on the whole, it's deteriorated. It wasn't great when Trump was president. It's not great now. And I don't see any serious effort to make these problems better. I see lots of terrible housing conditions, lots of people living doubled up, lots of illegal housing. It's supposed to be an apartment, but it's actually been split up into a bunch of rented rooms. Or you go in a building, and apartments are supposed to be from the second floor on up, and you go in the cellar, and there's apartments. I've literally seen apartments in a boiler room. I've literally seen they put, added onto the building, put apartments there. See that all the time. And it's about the same. And in terms of inflation, which has been galloping for the last 4 years, well, again, I mentioned we often go years at a time without a contract. That means years at a time without a raise. So, yeah, what you're worth can buy less. Oftentimes in my work, in terms of talking to my coworkers and talking with the members of the public that I interact with, eggs. People always bring up eggs, the price of eggs.
Yeah.
That's something that comes up a lot. Eggs and rent, and how much rents are, and how much, you know, I deal with a lot of people in the real estate industry, or people who are working, people who work in the real estate industry as workers, property managers, people like that. And a lot of a lot of them can't afford to live in the city, or they live under subpar conditions in the city, or they have long commutes from the suburbs, or because their pay is not kept up with inflation. And the Republicans demagogically brought that issue up. Now, do they plan to do anything about it? Of course not. But they at least pretended to care about it. And I found in a lot of Democratic political rhetoric, there's this sneering contempt for working people and our cost of living. This is why, you know, sometimes I want to break from politics, so I'll go on social media and I'll look for podcasts about other lighter topics, entertainment, sports. I was watching a sports podcast the other day. It was a sports podcast, a podcast about women's sports. Young African-American woman hosts it. She is the daughter of an NBA player. So obviously, this is a young woman who's been wealthy her entire life. And normally, it's sports content. She's pretty good, does a pretty good job of that. That's why I watch her podcast. But she was talking about the elections because it was day after the election. It was Thursday, actually. And just the contempt that she had for people talking about the price of eggs. Oh, the reason you can't afford eggs is because you bet on sports. And like, what? First off, most people don't bet on sports. And second, what's that got to do occasionally betting $20 on a game, which some people do. I've done it myself. What's that got to do with the fact that groceries cost a lot? I know every Saturday I'm reminded of how much groceries cost. That's when I do my shopping. Every Saturday I'm reminded how much groceries cost. And like, I see the amount of money I get from the city, same amount every 2 weeks, and the amount of money I spend on food. And I don't have kids. I just got to feed me. And it's like, I imagine there are people who do my job that have children, that have a bunch of kids. And how the hell do they manage? And I'm lucky. I have a rent that's relatively low. A lot of people who do what I do make the same money as me don't. How do they? Or they live in the suburbs and they have to have a car. I live in the city. I'm in Manhattan. I don't have to have a car. The people that do, they're getting slammed in the face with this every day. And the fact that at least the Republicans pretend to care about it. Are they going to do anything about it? Of course, they're absolutely not. But at least they're demagogically pretending to care. Not someone who is, here you have someone who is a young lady with the podcast, someone who's a lifelong Democrat, very just utterly contemptuous of people who, well, not everyone has a father who's a multimillionaire. I'm sorry. For a lot of people, the price of a dozen eggs going up is kind of a big deal. And when you act like that's not important or blame them, oh, it's your fault because you're betting on sports. And also, in that particular person's case, since they're in the sports industry, you're literally part of that problem. Mm-hmm. And you're blaming us for something that you're literally part of. Sports media are very much part of the whole sports gambling thing. They created that industry and promoted it. It expanded drastically in my lifetime. And why do people bet? Well, I know I work with a lot of people that buy lottery tickets. That is the type of gambling that a lot of people I know personally do. Why do they do that? My neighbor, he's a non-union construction worker. Every Friday, he's out there buying $50 worth of lottery tickets. Why? Because realistically, he's poor. He's going to be poor for the rest of his life. The only possibility of that changing, if by a bolt in the blue, he hits the lotto, maybe that might change. Why do people bet? Particularly, why do poor people bet? Because the only realistic way that their lives are ever going to get better is through the magical luck of hitting the lotto. So that's why people gamble. And that's also a symptom of that broader problem that, again, does either of the parties have a solution for that? The Republicans pretend to care. The Democrats are open. And they openly have a Marie Antoinette-like contempt. Let them eat cake, but damn, you can't even afford eggs. How are you going to make the cake?
All right. We have one last question for you guys. It's a really open-ended question. This has been a great panel so far. Let's end it out with this one. Big question. What is the way forward for labor? Should labor, organized labor, be doubling down on their support for Democrats to get better National Labor Relations Board composition? Should labor be organizing the unorganized? What do you guys think, Aaron, in your instance and others?
Well, doubling, no. First of all, the first part, no. Put it shortly. But, you know, these NLRB type of things, I mean, it's using a squirt gun and not a fire, basically. But whether that's a new party or trying to find more pro-worker units within the Democratic Party, I think that's an open question. Yeah, I'm probably one of the oldest members of this panel. So to see, you know, someone like, to see Bernie Sanders kind of character with all of his problems, you know, some of the other, you know, these people coming out, something I thought I'd see in my lifetime. So, you know, I think there's progress there. Is it going to go as far as we need? Probably not. But can it make meaningful improvement for workers? I think it's possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting being this dichotomy, because I think that's the open question everyone's asking, right? Like, I think, what of this de-alignment, again, going back to it, and, like, I think we've had sectors of, like, yeah, like, the New York Times, even Jacobin, talking about the necessity for the Democratic Party to, like, you know, find its way back to the working class. Like, but they also put forward this, like, dichotomy that the working class doesn't care about woke issues and that we have so-called woke issues. I don't know, but, like, needs to, like, talk about bread and butter demands. Like, what, and we see that even, like, it's, and it's everywhere. Like, I don't know, this week, that has been all that I've read. And it's frustrating because I think that it misses, like, you know, it's this idea that the working class doesn't care about the fight for democratic rights, you know, and it only cares about money in its pockets. And I think it's deeper than that. Like, I think the story of this election, of this, like, diverse alliance, like, this across, like, the working class, particularly the most precarious sectors of the working class, like, within Trump, shows the fact that it's not about, like, it's, I don't know, it's a little myopic to think about the working class as a monolith in that way. I think it is real that the American working class is incredibly fragmented, spread out, and incredibly diverse. And, like, within the next period, like, the attacks coming from the Trump base are real. Like, I don't, like, Trump is far more hegemonic within the Republican Party now than he was in 2016. They have local and state offices too. Like, we have a, like, all sectors of the legislative, like, chambers are under him. And these attacks are coming. Like, you know, like, yes, deportations happened under Biden. It happened under Obama, but it will happen under Trump too. And we can't normalize it. Like, especially, like, and I think that for us, like, we have to fight, like, labor has to take up the fight for every sector of worker to unite its rank and ranks, to unite all our struggles and to fight for a united front. There, it is, like, live or die for it. I have no intention of rescuing a Democratic Party that's dying. Like, let it die and let it be, like, let it die and, like, let's, like, put that in the ashes of history. The Democratic Party wants to build up the alliance with the working class because it's the way that the state mediates its relationship. It's one of the ways that a capitalist state, which is absolutely antagonistic to every single interest of our class, relates to our class. In the next period, in all of this, like, yeah, like, with nearshoring, with where American capital has to find a way out, the Democrats will actually, like, I don't know, like, I think it's absolutely possible that they can, with, like, you know, an economist program, with the bread and butter demands, like, win over a sector of the American working class by offering some crumbs, while actually, like, putting forward huge attacks against the working class here, as well as across the world. And, like, that we cannot stand for, because that division is going to take us down, and we see that even now. And I think that, like, it's apps and, but, and yeah, like, so I think the fight for a united front against every single attack levied on our class in the next period is absolutely essential. And we have the seeds of this. We have the seeds of this in the Palestine movement. We have the seeds of this in the students who occupy the universities and in rank and file union members fighting against labor Zionism and their own fucking unions. Like, it's incredible that seven major unions passed a resolution fighting for arms embargo against Israel. Like, it's absolutely antithetical to the labor movement so far. And I think that we have the ability to put that fight, an actual class-independent fight that doesn't rely on the institutions of the state or the Democratic Party to win. And if we can do that, that has the seeds of an actual political alternative for us to build a party that can fight with its own program, not just from a defensive place, but can go on the offensive and articulate this struggle for both, like, you know, against oppression and exploitation. Yes. And that's the fight for socialism.
Yes.
Here, here. Ali, I'm going to pass it to you. But first, as we wind down our panel, we do have a hat that we're going to pass around to help pay for the space, pay for food, pay for drinks and all that. So we'll get that started and going around. Ellie, go ahead, your chance.
Yeah, so I think there is a lot of doomsday rhetoric out there, especially among liberals. And I definitely unite with what Shumi is putting forward about the need for independent political action of the working class. And I think, yeah, I mean, we shouldn't let the Democrats resurrect themselves. We should let them wither away. We should be excited about our enemy turning on each other. And whether that's, within the the divisions between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, but also whether that's the divisions within the unions. I think we should use that and seize on those opportunities to clarify to the workers that, you know, if you're going to fight for crumbs, we actually have an ability to use the unions as the most basic organization, you know, fighting organization of the working class, not just, you know, to get crumbs or to get reforms passed, but to really become weapons of the workers, tools to be used in their emancipation, for their entire liberation, their emancipation from wage labor, for socialism. And, you know, there's a lot of, you look at the state of the working class movement today, you know, we shouldn't delude ourselves that it's at a low stage. You know, there is obviously an upsurge. But what we can do is begin to take action to, you know, whether that's in the form of a labor party that arises, of unions coming together to fight for political reforms as a first step to asserting their political independence, or whether that's in the efforts to build a communist party. I think, you know, we have to be open to deeply understanding the ruling class, deeply understanding our enemy, but also deeply understanding ourselves, understanding what our forces are, being objective about what kind of power we have, what we need to learn. You know, I think conversations like these are an important step forward. We need to have debates about the elections. We need to have debates about labor and its, you know, relationship to politics, because if we don't have that clarity ourselves of understanding what the role of the unions can be, what the role of communists and revolutionaries should be, what they've, understanding history and understanding how the history of class struggle has taken place, you know, in various places and successfully implemented socialism in Russia and China at a certain point. You know, if we don't have that clarity ourselves, we're not going to be able to take advantage of these openings. And so, yeah, I think this is a really exciting first step, and there are other first steps that we'll see down the road, and it's an exciting time to be inspired.
Thank you, Ellie.
You can clap for that, yeah.
You could be inspired. You could be excited. All right, Greg, what do you think? What should we be doing?
All right, well, first off, let's take a look at what situation we're in. America, we've had a working class that's been divided since the first slave ship docked here and since the first Indian village got massacred 400 years ago. We're divided by race, and that has been the fundamental, that's been the original sin of America, and that's been the one thing that's kept us where we are. That's why we don't have a workers' party. That's why the labor movement at its peak only represented a third of the workforce. And where was labor in its weakest? In the South and in the West. In the South, where the black workers were. In the West, where the Latino and indigenous workers were. It's always been where labor has been in its weakest. Labor unions were racially segregated right up till the Civil Rights Act passed and after the Civil Rights Act passed. That was something that's been, so we need to build a unified workers' party, a unified multiracial workers' party, including workers from all backgrounds, because that's always been what's hung us up, is that we're divided by race, and we need to overcome that. And also all the other divisions in the working class. People talk about, oh, we should just talk about, like the sister down the panel for me just said, about, well, we can't talk about the social issues. We have to talk about bread and butter. We got to talk about both. Because, well, the LGBT community, most of them are working class people just like us. We all have the luxury of being homophobic or transphobic. We all have the luxury of being racist. We all have the luxury of being sexist. All those issues are class issues because they're used as ways to divide the working class. The bosses promote those things, but as ways to divide us, we have to be united. So we need, above all, is the Democratic Party a solution? Absolutely not. The Democratic Party, the party of Joe Biden and the party of Eric Adams, is that a way forward for us? Absolutely not. And yeah, exactly. Well, thank you. Well, we need to build a revolutionary workers' party. As far as what we call it, I work with a lot of Eastern European immigrants. Maybe the word communist. I myself am a communist, but I know a lot of my coworkers, they think of communism, they think of the Soviet Union, and they grew up in the Soviet Union. And maybe not someone they want to go with. But certainly building a workers' party is what we need to do. Totally break with the Democratic Party. Democratic Party needs to be, that's the main obstacle to building a working class movement. Democratic Party needs to be destroyed. We need to be the ones to do it. And thank you. And one of the main tasks of that Workers' Party, besides defeating the Democratic Party electorally, is also going to be rebuilding the labor movement. As I said before, only 34% of public sector workers are unionized, only 6% of private sector workers. The future of our class, young workers, only 2% of workers under 30 are union members. That's only going to get worse. I mean, in my previous life in construction, I saw in the time I was in construction in New York City, I got in the unions, half the construction workforce is unionized. By the time I left, barely 10%. And I was only in 24 years. I saw that happen. It's gotten worse since I left there. We need to build a new labor movement. People talk, one of the excuses you hear in the labor world for why we have to support the Democratic Party is the National Labor Relations Act. Let's take a look at that for a second. The purpose of the National Labor Relations Act, if you actually read the statute, if you read the preamble, what does it say? Why did they pass this law? Is it labor's Magna Carta? Is it intended for workers' rights? Nope. Well, the basis of all federal legislation is federal legislation has to be in certain narrow areas of law they're allowed to regulate. One of those things is regulating interstate commerce. And the actual text of the Labor Management Relations Act of 1935, as amended, is, and its successor, the Labor Management Relations Act of 1948, Taft-Hartley Act, which is the amended version of the National Labor Relations Act that's in effect today, it states that the purpose, the reason they're regulating labor relations is to prevent labor disputes from interfering with interstate commerce. It says it right there in the statute. Let me say it again for the people in the back. To prevent labor disputes from interfering with interstate commerce. It's not there to help us. It's there to prevent us from interfering with interstate commerce. The whole point of a strike is to interfere with interstate commerce. The point of the law is to prevent labor disputes from interfering with interstate commerce. And everything about the NLRB, the fact that it's so difficult to organize a union, you all found that out the hard way. The fact that it's so easy for employers to meddle in the unionization process. The fact that unions are so limited in what they do. In construction, there's 17 different unions. If one union is on strike, the other unions are legally supposed to cross that picket line and scab on that strike. Anyone who's ever been in a multi-craft workplace in the private sector, you might have seen this happen. All that is because of the law. It's not a bug. It's a feature. So what we need to do in terms of rebuilding, one of the big tasks of the Workers' Party is rebuilding a new labor movement, but not like what we got now. Not like, oh, we're going to go through the NLRB process and ask permission from the employer and the government to have a union, and then only bargain around the narrow range of things that unions are allowed to do under that act. Well, that's going to be a hard no. We need to build, and also all the First Amendment rights that we have in this country that unions give up. All the rights, there's lots of restrictions on picketing. What the picket signs can say. I found this out when I was in the carpenters. I was a steward. I was often involved in picketing. There's restrictions on the words you can put on a picket line are legally restricted. How you can picket. The fact that American picketing is very much less effective than picketing in other countries. And there's a lot of stuff you can do in a political protest you can't do on a union picket line. Well, we need to not do that. And we need to build a new workers' party and a new labor movement built on the basis of, with the objective of ending the capitalist system. Our current labor movement is pro-capitalist. They believe in it. A lot of them are very wealthy because of that. We need to build a new labor movement with the objective of ending the capitalist system and creating a working class controlled society. That's a tall order. We're not going to do that in a day. But that needs to be the whole point of our organizing, has to be build a workers' party, build a new labor movement, and with the objective of ending this system and replacing it with one run by those of us who produce all the necessary goods and services of society.
Yes.
Thank you, Gregory. Should we do questions, or Pete's will be here in five? All right. We were maybe going to do some question and answers, but I assume you're all going to stick around for the rest of the event. So
we could do it now.
We got pizza in five, so I think it's a good time to break. Everybody, thank you so much. Another big round of applause for our panelists. This has been really great, so thank you to all of you. And again, stick around. We'll be having pizza in about five and then a town hall. So thank you. Finger to the president, screaming fuck censorship. If Obama got that president election, and then PE boys about to make an intervention. Fuck what I once said. I want the bloodshed. Cause nowadays, for respect, you gotta pump lead. I guess Columbine was listening to Shaka Khan, and Pokemon wasn't getting recognized at Comic Con. It's like we've been content with losing, and half our students falling victim to the institution. Jobs are scarce since the scientific revolution, and little kids are shooting Uzis cause it's given to them. Little weapon, code name Smith & Wesson, and you'll be quick to catch a bullet like an interception. If your man's trying to disrespect it, send a message and it's over in a millisecond, nigga.